Welcome to the Center of Everywhere podcast, where we explore stories of rural Minnesotans who are making a difference in their communities. Rural isn't in the middle of nowhere. It is in the center of everywhere.
Welcome to the Center of Everywhere podcast. My name is Julie Tesh, and I am the president and CEO of the Center for Rural Policy and Development. We are on season 2, episode 5 of our podcast series, and we're very excited to have today with us our own board members, actually, and one of our staff members. We have Whitney Oakes, who is a contract researcher for us, who has a great new report coming out on energy. And then we also have Jennifer Cady and Tim Velde, who are board members for the Center for Rural Policy and Development. And I will let all three of them introduce themselves next. But we hope that you enjoy this episode of the Center of Everywhere.
Thank you so much, Julie. Yeah, it's pretty exciting. A new report on the shifting energy infrastructure in the state of Minnesota will be coming out this Friday. So probably by the time you hear this podcast, it'll be out and live on the website. But the basis of this report basically is that in the past 2 decades, the state of Minnesota has undergone a major shift in energy infrastructure, right from coal and fossil fuels toward renewables. So although there's still like a long way to go to meet the state's carbon reduction goals, I felt that this energy shift was worthy of discussion at the center because rural utility providers face some of the largest barriers to an energy transition, which is really, you know, something important to think about as we're making this shift towards renewables. So it's namely co-ops that are facing these barriers, but, you know, investor-owned firms, particularly in rural areas, are finding barriers to renewables as well. And so this report's purpose was to kind of take stock of the energy shift, but from a rural context, basically. All right, so Tim, Jennifer, I think it would be really great for the listeners to hear a little bit about you and your connection to energy policy and distribution in rural Minnesota. Tim?
Well, thank you, Whitney. I guess for myself, I'm out in Southwest Minnesota. I'm on the board of directors of a local rural electric co-op. I'm also on the state rural electric co-op board and the national rural electric board. So hear a lot of reports and a lot of things that are going on. And I would like to say that what I'm saying here today are things that are my perspective on what I've heard. They're probably not unanimously things that everyone thinks, but this is things that I feel that I've heard and learned. So I'm a farmer by trade and rural electric director by election, I guess.
Thank you. And Jennifer.
Great. Hi, Whitney. Thank you so much for having me. My name is Jennifer Cady. I am a board member for the Center for Rural Policy and Development and am very happy to be here for this conversation today. I work as the manager of regulatory strategy and policy at Minnesota Power, which is an electric utility serving northeastern Minnesota, essentially from Duluth up to the Canadian border in International Falls, over to Little Falls in the west. In my role at Minnesota Power, I work on emerging energy policy issues, regulation with our state Minnesota Public Utilities Commission, and stakeholder engagement. So really looking forward to the conversation today.
Awesome. Yeah, it's really great to have, you know, two people, one person from an investor-owned utility provider perspective and one from a cooperative, since, you know, as I've dug into this research, I've noticed, right, how without either, the state of Minnesota couldn't run as is. But I think, you know, we often think of like Xcel Energy, the biggest provider in the state, and forget about other investor-owned firms or smaller cooperatives. So one thing I kind of wanted to start with, because our listeners might not be aware, is how energy is generated and distributed. And So, Tim, could you start us off with some key differences between cooperative and investor-owned utility providers?
Well, the electric co-op distribution and generation and transmission basically started in 1935 under the Roosevelt administration. Most of the towns and incorporated areas had electric power from investor-owned or municipals. And the rural parts of not only Minnesota, but the whole country didn't have power provided to them simply because most of the investor-owned didn't see that they could get a return from on their investment of starting, putting energy out in the country. Electric co-ops were formed. In Minnesota, we have 44 distribution co-ops, and all they do is, send the power down the line to farm places and some businesses on the outside of towns. And there are six G&Ts. A G&T is a generating and transmitting co-op that the co-ops, different distribution co-ops belong to. So we're kind of providing the power to people that were overlooked in the beginning and, trying to keep the lights on out in the country too.
Absolutely. So with this layered structure of generation and transmission cooperatives, as well as electric distribution cooperatives, that involves quite a bit of teamwork, right? To make sure that everyone's voice is being heard, all the members' voices are being heard, right?
Yes, distribution co-op, each of the 44 distribution co-ops is governed and regulated by a board elected by the local people in that area. And the co-ops that are a part of one of the G&Ts, they band together and they elect a director to be on the board of the generating and transmitting co-op. So everything is very member-centered and member-focused. And one of the things, we aren't looking for a return for investors or anything. We're simply trying to operate as a nonprofit. And if there is a return or if there is money left at the end of the year, that's given back to the members according to how much power they purchased in the form of a dividend.
Jennifer, could you tell us a little bit about how investor-owned utility providers operate?
Yeah, I'd be happy to, Whitney. So investor-owned utilities are regulated not by members like the co-ops are, but by the state in which they operate. So more than 100 years ago, America decided through our Supreme Court that electricity is an essential service and it's in the public interest to electrify America. And so what we operate under is what's known as the regulatory compact. And it's kind of a structure that some people, aren't super familiar with. And they'll often refer to utilities as monopolies. So we are what's called a natural monopoly, meaning that it's a very capital intensive industry to generate and deliver electricity. And so it makes sense that there are not multiple providers in one area. So our regulatory compact essentially provides one company with a defined service territory. And so we have both the privilege and the obligation to serve every customer within that service territory. And in the absence of competition, we have regulation by the state. So in Minnesota, that's the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission. We also have other state agencies that work to ensure the public interest is being upheld, namely the Department of Commerce and the Office of the Attorney General. So what that looks like in practice is that anything an investor-owned utility wants to do in terms of its long-term resource plans, new resource acquisitions, the rates that we charge customers, has to go through a very public, ultimately approved by regulators. So that's kind of a primary difference between IOUs and co-ops in the state of Minnesota. One other difference I'd highlight is that IOUs, like Minnesota Power, we generate our own electricity. So we own our own power plants and our own renewable energy resources and generate that power that we then also deliver to customers. So those are a couple of the differences between the two.
So, you know, my understanding too is that cooperatives provide the majority of electricity to rural areas. However, you know, Jennifer, Minnesota Power, like that also takes up a large part of northeastern Minnesota, you know, showing that there are investor-owned firms serving the more rural parts of the state as well.
Yep, that's a great point, Whitney. So while investor-owned utilities generally serve urban areas, in the state of Minnesota, Xcel Energy is the investor-owned utility that serves the Minneapolis-St. Paul metro area. But there are two other investor-owned utilities. Minnesota Power, we serve northeastern Minnesota, and Otter Tail Power, which serves kind of western Minnesota. So both MP, Otter Tail, and some parts of Xcel Energy service territory are certainly in greater Minnesota.
So the infrastructure involved in getting electricity to your home or business, you know, that's different in a rural versus an urban area, namely because of, you know, like the distance energy needs to travel via transmission lines or other methodologies. Is there any other big differences, Tim, that you see in how rural energy providers operate in a rural area versus in an urban area?
Just the information I've looked up and received. The service density, well, that's the number of members or number of people receiving energy for every per mile of line. The average is for municipals is 47 members or people consuming energy per mile of line that they put up. Investor owns have roughly 35 people per mile of line. And electric co-ops in the state of Minnesota, the average is 7 members. The particular co-op that I am a member of, we only have 1.7 members per mile of line. So the cost of the infrastructure per person or per meter is quite high, and also the cost of servicing that area, keeping it up. You know, we're traveling longer distances to maintain the lines, inspect the lines, and put the lines back up after a storm or something. So I see that as electric co-ops have versus more concentrated areas that are covered by investor owns and municipals.
Right.
And I would add, Whitney, if I could, to that, kind of two additional considerations. One, in rural areas, you know, depending on the geography of the state, you have some really unique kind of natural barriers to overcome. And I speak from the northeastern part of the state, where we are blessed with lots and lots of wetlands, which means lots of swamps, which can cost a lot more to run lines through than other parts of the state. So I think geography in rural areas can make an impact on cost of maintaining those lines, as Tim said. And then also some of the new technologies that may be cost effective and work really well in more densely populated areas may not work as well or may require additional upgrades where there's less population density. So these are things like distributed solar, battery technology, electric vehicle charging. Sometimes the system needs some additional investment in less densely populated areas.
Absolutely. Well, and Jennifer, I had a question for you as well. I wanted to know a little bit more about Minnesota Power's customer base. Are you predominantly working with households and small businesses like a lot of co-ops?
Thanks, Whitney. No, Minnesota Power is one of the most unique electric utilities in the country in that the majority, over 75% of our energy sales go to a handful of industrial customers. And this is unique because we serve the natural resources-based economy of northeastern Minnesota, which is predominantly iron mining and paper production. So we provide power to mining operations and paper mills, And actually, residential customers are only about 13% of our energy sales. So in some respects, Minnesota Power can look more like a co-op in terms of the number of customers that we serve, but the amount of energy that we provide to our customers is what differentiates us. And it's because of these large industrial customers in northeastern Minnesota that we're privileged to serve.
Tim, what is providing energy like for you on the co-op side? Is it predominantly households?
Yes, in the state, about roughly 60% of the members receiving energy from co-ops are residences, and the rest are commercial or industrial. Out here in the western Minnesota, we're at about 80% residential and 20% of our power. If you look at the number of members, we just have a handful of members that would be considered commercial or industrial. But as far as the amount of power that's sold, we're about 20% industrial and commercial. So we're running a lot of miles of line to homes and that don't necessarily generate a lot of revenue per mile, but we're scrappy and try to make things work as best we possibly can to keep our rates affordable for our members.
And is that a challenge for you, keeping rates affordable for your members?
It is somewhat challenging. The biggest challenge, or I think the biggest concern, if you talk to most co-ops, is making sure we have reliability. Reliability, everybody wants when they flip the switch in their house, they want the lights to go on. And I think that's one of the concerns that are probably top of mind for most co-ops is keeping reliability one of our primary issues. We have, as co-ops, we have kind of a three things that we concentrate on. One is safety. We want all of our line people to go home at the end of their shift, and we want the residences to have safe power at their home. The other thing is reliability. Everybody wants the lights to come on, like I say. And the other thing is reasonable rates. And reasonable is kind of determined by, how you can get the job done. And if there is a return, like I said, that any return or money at the end of the year is returned to people in the form of a dividend. So we try to be as reasonable as we can. Right now for us, our average retail rate to our members is about 10.6 cents a kilowatt hour. So we feel we're keeping our rates, as reasonable as we possibly can.
And Jennifer, I know utility rates and reliability, those are also really, they're important for everyone, right? Anyone that uses electricity, but it has a unique importance for the manufacturing firms that Minnesota Power serves, correct?
Yeah, that's correct, Whitney. So in northeastern Minnesota, two of our key industries, iron mining and paper production, are globally competitive. So they are competing with a commodity in the global marketplace, but they're incredibly energy intensive. So both, paper mills, iron mines use large amounts of energy. So electricity is an important input cost in the overall cost of their product. And so a challenge that they face is when they're competing in a global marketplace where maybe the cost of energy is cheaper in other countries or potentially subsidized in other countries, it can put them at a price disadvantage. So we work very, very hard to keep our rates affordable. And it's an important consideration as we talk about this historic energy transition that we ensure that our customers are able to remain financially healthy with affordable electric rates.
Absolutely. And that's you know, perfect transition here into kind of our main topic. So now that we've talked a little bit about how utility providers operate, let's get into this shift in energy infrastructure towards renewables. I want to start by informing listeners of the Minnesota Next Generation Act. So this was passed in 2007 under Governor Tim Pawlenty, and it set carbon reduction goals for the state of Minnesota, namely an 80% carbon reduction goal by 2050. And so there were interim goals set along in 10 or 20 year increments to see if we're on track. And right now, Minnesota is lagging a little bit behind what their 2030 goal is. And so in talking with both of you, what are, if you could give me a quick summary, some benefits and barriers towards this transition toward renewables that the state has committed to? And Tim, if you would like to start.
Okay. I looked up some things with the G&T that we get our power from. In 2000, we were 85% coal. Presently, we're 40% coal, but we've increased our natural gas to offset power that's isn't being generated by coal. But we've also reduced sulfur emissions by 85%. And even though the demand for power from that we're having to serve has gone up, we've actually had a 25% reduction in CO2. One of the barriers we have in accessing renewable energy, co-ops, since they're not for profit, we can't take advantage of the production tax credits for wind and solar that others can. So we have to partner with a third party, and any credit that comes back to them by us getting a power purchase agreement from them, we lose roughly 20% of the incentive to do that goes to the person who's buying, you know, putting up the wind or solar, and we're buying the power from them. We've been working with our local senators and representatives trying to get a law passed, which would be direct pay, where the government would give us the same benefit instead of a tax credit, which reduces the income tax that someone pays. It would cost the government the same to just give us credit for building that. So that's been a little bit of a barrier. We can't take advantage of some of the savings. One of the things co-ops have done is with partners, we've invested about $30 million into carbon capture and also carbon capture and reuse. We have one of the plants that has demonstrated and shown that they can catch the exhaust coming out the slipstream, and they're separating the carbon out, and they've actually turned that carbon coming out of a coal plant into a concrete that they're making concrete blocks or cinder blocks out of it. So we see, you know, some of this capturing the carbon or reusing it as a way of reducing carbon on top of going to renewables.
Well, and one thing that comes to mind for me too, when I think about cooperatives and this transition, is that because cooperatives are, you know, member-owned nonprofits, they've often relied on loans from the federal government to support infrastructure needs in the past, which have been predominantly focused on coal and coal-fired plants, since that's what our energy infrastructure was based off of. So I imagine it's also challenging if you have outstanding debt towards the government or a private lender for investments that made a lot of sense at the time, when now you're trying to build a whole different type of infrastructure.
Yes, and I'm not sure a lot of people are aware of it, but when the power needs in rural Minnesota or rural country was growing, they were looking at putting in gas-powered, you know, natural gas-powered plants. At that time, natural gas was very short and hard to come by, and the federal government actually prohibited the use of natural gas for producing electricity. And that's the time when a lot of coal plants were built. And to, you know, like I said, with, you know, 1.7 members per mile or even seven as an average for the state, the cost of that was very, quite expensive. And the only way you could do it is amateurize it over, you know, 50 years or more. And any upgrades that have been done to the plant, was the same thing there, had to be amateurized over a long period of time. So we have a lot of outstanding debt that we can service and we can pay over a period of time. But we can't, if we shut down something and build something renewable or build something new to replace it, now we have our debt, you know, in two places, and it's about impossible to service debt from two places for, you know, doing the same thing. So that's been a challenge to figure out too. So
absolutely, you know, particularly when you're trying to keep your members' interests in mind. And one thing I think about is how, you know, household incomes in rural Minnesota are lower on average than household incomes in urban areas too. So there's even a price sensitivity on the household side towards, you know, rate increases or what might happen in order to, you know, afford to build this new infrastructure.
That's correct. And I, one thing I should mention, right, and I think you've probably heard of the Nemadji plant that's being built. I think it's in Superior, Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, Minnesota Power is a part of that. Dairyland Power, which is a co-op G&T, and Basin Electric, which is a G&T, are working together on that to, you know, for the building the plant, and then they'll each be entitled to their particular share of the power coming out of there. So investor owns and co-ops, you know, work together. You know, like I say, we're investor owns are simply looking at making sure their members or their customers are kept whole and have the power on. And it's the same thing for a co-op. So we work with partners in many different areas to do things, you know, as efficiently as possible.
Yeah. And Jennifer, could you tell us a little bit about the transition towards renewables from your perspective at Minnesota Power?
Yeah, thanks, Whitney. First, I just want to highlight, you know, you had mentioned in your introductory comments that Minnesota is a little bit behind in our carbon reduction goals. And I just want to take a moment and highlight that the electric sector has done an incredible job reducing emissions, and we're pretty significantly further ahead than some other sectors like transportation, mm-hmm. agriculture, industry. So I think that our sector specifically has met our benchmarks and is doing a fantastic job throughout the state of Minnesota. But Minnesota Power's carbon reduction journey is remarkable from a number of perspectives. In 2005, Minnesota Power was 95% coal-based generation, with only 5% renewable coming from our legacy hydro stations. Since then, in 2020, so just 15 years later, we became the first utility in the state of Minnesota to deliver power to our customers that was 50% renewable. So half of the power that we provide our customers is from renewable energy resources, primarily from hydro, wind, and some small solar. So we're incredibly proud of that transition, but that's been made possible by the closure of small coal units across northern Minnesota. So in 2005, Minnesota Power owned and operated 9 coal units. Since then, we have closed, idled, or remissioned 7 of those. And so when we talk about kind of the energy transition, and particularly what that means for people in rural parts of the state, I think looking at the impact of those power plant closures is a really important piece to not lose sight of. So just speaking just from our experience, our power plants are located in small communities where they provide a bulk of the tax revenue for the city, the school district, sometimes the county. They provide an important source of employment, and the employees working at those plants, you know, not only do they live and work in those communities, but they donate their time and their talent, and they're the ones serving on you know, local nonprofit boards and coaching soccer teams. And so that kind of social fabric piece of a power plant host community is an important thing to consider as we talk about that energy transition. And so Minnesota Power has outlined our vision to get to 100% carbon-free future by 2050. And we believe very strongly that sustainability should be considered holistically. And as we continue this next phase of the transformation, that we consider, of course, the climate, but also the impact on customers and the impact on communities. Because, you know, for us to have a healthy climate, we also need kind of to be holistically healthy. Our communities need to be thriving and our customers need to be healthy as well.
That point about holistic sustainability is really important, particularly when we're talking about in an industry and an infrastructure base that has been so important to the development of our state and our nation as a whole. You know, like this transition is a very big undertaking. And at least from my perspective, I think sometimes the politics of renewables can kind of shroud what's actually going on in our electric industries and in this shift. So another question that I had for you two was about disagreements about this shift. So when I was doing research for this report, I spoke to a lot of cooperative managers from different parts of the state because I wanted to hear as many perspectives as possible. And there were some, like the folks at Great River Energy, who you know, have recently committed to 50% renewable by 2030, are seeing renewables as cheaper and more stable long-term, while there are other co-op managers I've spoken with who really believe further investments in coal are what would benefit them in the future because that's where they have so much money invested already. And I was wondering, Tim, if you could speak on those disagreements at all, or if you see that as someone who's working in co-ops, this kind of these questions about where do we go from here?
Where do we go from here is beyond a question. It is the question. I think, you know, when you look at, right now, everything is transmission system is built from central station power, you know, a huge amount of power coming from one location. As we go to more renewables, they're scattered all over the country, and you have to get those connected into your build transmission to get them into the main transmission system. And we're a part of SPP, which is Southwest Power Pool, which covers a huge footprint. I'm not even sure there's like 9 states or 10 states, something like that. And there have been times when, demand isn't high and it's a beautiful sunny day and the wind is blowing, when what they call penetration of renewables, either wind and solar, has gotten as far as 85% of our system is being run on renewables. There are other times when it's cold and it's windy and it's snowing and there's high demand, it's been down to just about zero from renewables. And, you could have renewables in, Southwest United States or something that are running, but how do you get that power all the way up here? You know, it requires an enormous investment in transmission if you're going to get that. Batteries would be another way, but there aren't any long-term batteries available. You need a battery that can provide power for, 4 days in a blizzard or something. So, from some people look at, they're closing down a coal plant, reliable source of energy, and they're going to buy whatever extra power they need on the market from someone else who's running something, which will work if there's plenty of power, but you're never sure as demand goes up, the cost of buying that power goes up. So it could have a dramatic effect on your rates. If you're producing power and, like we're trying to sequester the carbon coming out of a coal plant, or even a natural gas plant. If you can do that, you can provide, you know, carbon-free or, you know, highly reduced carbon energy from a central station and have the transmission system there to get it around. So, you know, which direction do you go, or which direction does the country take is going to be interesting to see. You know, I'd like to see more investment or more research done on carbon capture. I think it's a way we can use existing resources and still have either reduced or carbon-free energy sent out to the country.
Because you are a member-owned co-op, has there been any challenges, or maybe I should rephrase this, as a member-owned co-op, what does community buy-in look like among members for these decisions? So are cooperative leaders making a lot of these choices on their own, or is there a lot of input from members?
In our co-op, like I say, we're a very small co-op. We have less than 5,000 members, you know, in our co-op, and we have a 7-member board, you know, which means I represent about 700 people, and they're people that I see in church and basketball games, and, you know, at the hardware store, the elevator, and grocery store. So we're, and all of the boards, they're local community people. They're very approachable, and every once in a while, somebody comes up and kind of nips at your heels a little bit, and others come up to you and say, boy, I'm glad their power stayed on during that storm. And so that's part of it. We do hear from people that think we should be going with more renewables. And we, you know, explain to them that, you know, what we've done so far. A lot of people don't realize the story. You know, like I said, we were in 2000, we were 85% coal. Now we're about 40%, you know, so that's a huge reduction. We have increased our gas, but, you know, not nearly as much as, you know, what we've, you know, kind of closed down on coal. So we're doing the best we can. We're trying to transition. We're very affected by the opinions of our members, and we take that into consideration, and also the practical aspects of, you know, how can we do this? And that's, you know, when you see somebody on the street, you got to look them in the eye and tell them we're doing the best we can.
Yeah, it's a lot to juggle all at once.
Yes, it is.
Jennifer, what does community buy-in look like for you, whether that's among your customers, your client base, or, you know, the investors who are also very, you know, interested in the workings of Minnesota Power?
Yeah, thanks, Whitney. You know, I think the most important thing is that all important stakeholders, customers, communities, regulators are aligned and moving towards a common direction. And I think we have that in Minnesota, where we have energy policy that's, you know, telling us the direction that they want Minnesota utilities to go. And I think that's helpful. I think that the big question, though, is the pace and the path of transformation going forward, right? And thinking about how that transition is a just one, and how we consider equity. And from a rural perspective, you know, I talked a little bit about plant closures and what that means to workers. And so I think that being aligned on a common objective, which is, you know, a cleaner energy system, is really helpful. And what we seek community, you know, input on through our facilitated stakeholder processes is really the pace and path of transformation. So what do we want this next stage of this remarkable transition we're all going through? What do we want that to look like? And how do we make sure that the next steps we take are thoughtful and intentional and provide the most benefits to the people that live and work in the region that we serve? And so those are some of the things that we're trying to be very thoughtful for, or thoughtful about, as we continue this transformation to a cleaner energy future.
Yeah, and you send out a survey through Minnesota Power, correct, to your customer base?
We do a number of stakeholder engagement processes. So as a fully regulated utility, we have to provide a long-term plan to the Public Utilities Commission on how we will meet the needs of our customers. That's called the Integrated Resource Plan, and Minnesota has one of the most sophisticated IRP processes in the nation. And through that process, we do a number of stakeholder engagement meetings. We send out surveys to hear directly from our customers. And then we develop our plan, hopefully based on the input and feedback that we've received so far. And then it goes through a very public process where advocates, community members, customers of all sizes can weigh in and have their voice heard. And ultimately, the regulators, approve or modify or deny those long-term plans. And so I think in the state of Minnesota, there are a lot of opportunities for the public to have kind of direct input on where energy is going long-term.
Yeah, that's so great to hear. And thank you so much, Tim and Jennifer, for joining me today on the podcast. I just have, I think, one last question to ask you both as a bit of a wrap up. And that question is, what's something you would tell the legislature if they asked you how to better support this energy transition? And I know, Tim, you touched on some of the legislative work you're already doing, so I'll let you answer first.
I think, the idea that we could get G&Ts could get direct pay for putting in renewables instead of having to go through a third party. And that would be part of it. The other thing, we talked briefly about the debt that co-ops have. Right now, there's legislation that exists that, interest rates have come way down. Anything that we did that we financed years ago, might be at 7-8% interest or some even higher than that. And by law, we're not allowed to refinance that. And that's financed through the federal government. So through rural utility services. So I think, that would help too, if you could refinance your debt on existing infrastructure that you have right now, that would free up a bunch of money, save money for our members, and allow us to probably look more at other infrastructure needs that we have. The other thing, everything that we set out goals, we know we're going to be in a carbon constrained world. Everybody admits that. But I think as we're going forward, it's great to have these goals. We do our best to achieve them. But there have to be, or there should be, off ramps so that if you can't meet it for legitimate reasons, you don't end up having to pay fines, which simply goes on the cost of power to your members and that. So I guess that would be my take on it, that it's probably hard to tell someone, trust us, we're doing the best job we can, but we actually are.
Jennifer, how about you? What's something you would tell the legislature if they asked you how to better support this energy transition?
Well, thanks, Whitney. What I would tell the legislature is I think it's important for us to think strategically about what role the state of Minnesota can play in this transformation. So each utility, of course, is moving forward and decarbonizing their system. And we're doing that in part to meet the energy policy goals of the state of Minnesota. But there are some things that might be better done by the state as opposed to individual utilities. And some of those things that come to mind, are assistance with host community transition or worker retraining, or other things that the state could do to help keep electric rates down while we transform our system that is truly in the public interest for everyone who lives in the state. So I think, it would be helpful if the legislature maybe thought about, what role the state could play in helping that transition. Certainly, I think the utilities are doing their part and we are transforming, but there may be things that can help with that you know, holistic view of sustainability, helping our communities and our customers as well.
And when you say host community transition, that's regarding the communities with coal plants that are closing, right?
Yes, that's right.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, you two, for joining me. I really, really appreciate this.
You've been listening to the Center of Everywhere podcast, where we explore stories of rural Minnesotans who are making a difference in their communities. Rural isn't in the middle of nowhere. It is in the center of everywhere.